The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Do you want a beautiful lawn? Enter True Green, the easiest way to get a great lawn. Just water and mow and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and more. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour, and they have a verified best price, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com, TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people. Guaranteed.
The following program is a PodcastOne.com production.
He's a world champion wrestler, best-selling author, actor, and lead singer of Fozzy. Now he's rocking the podcast world. This is Talk Is Jericho. Talk Is Jericho, starring Chris Jericho.
Welcome to Talk Is Jericho. I'm the king of the podcast world, and you're my headline king and queen. I'm the king of the podcast world. Come live your secret dreams right here, man. And guess what? It's Friday.
It's Friday, gotta get down on Friday.
That's right. The remedy for boredom has arrived. The People's Podcast is here. Let's go for a ride.
Start a fire, start a roar.
Right now.
Do you wanna take a stand?
Fuzzy record, Do You Want to Start a War? That was Do You Want to Start a War. Go check out the video now on YouTube. You won't regret it. Playboy Playmate of the Year, Irina Voronina, is in the video, and she looks hot, hot, hot. Go check it out. Lots of dancing girls, lots of Maximum Rockicity, which fits because we've got a lot of Maximum Rockicity today with Slash Part 2, and we get into some amazing topics off the beaten path of what Slash usually talks about. We're talking about the Rolling Stones. We're talking about dinosaurs, what his theory and what my theory are as to why dinosaurs are extinct. We talk about our favorite dinosaurs, all the different weird and different variations and species of dinosaurs, and organically we started talking about Guns N' Roses, what it was like to be in the most famous rock band in the world at that point in time. I also straight out asked him if he thought there would ever be a Guns N' Roses reunion, and you'll hear what he said about that. He talked about getting sober, what it's like playing guitar on stage when he was under the influence. So many great, great topics today. Slash Part 2 coming up. But first, you know what I have to do here. I got to say thanks to all of you for using my links every time you shop at Amazon. Easiest way to support the show, and I appreciate you supporting the show. I know there's hundreds, if not thousands, of podcasts for you to schwoz from. I appreciate you schwozing mine twice a week. And the way you can really show your appreciation is every time you go shopping, use one of my Amazon links. If you do that, Amazon kicks back a couple bucks to the show to help us cover production costs, all right? I got links for Amazon USA, Amazon UK, Amazon Canada. A, you know you got to buy some stuff. The holidays are just around the corner. So go to podcastone.com. Click on the Keep Our Podcast Free banner at the top of the page. Then hit the Talk is Jericho button. You can get all kinds of cool stuff on Amazon. The new Fozzy record, Do You Want to Start a War? How about my new book, the best-selling, the best in the world at what? I have no idea. Many people saying it's the favorite Chris Jericho book out of the three I've written. If you haven't read it yet, what are you waiting for, man? If you listen to this show, you obviously like hearing my stories. You obviously like hearing my tales. Obviously like hearing my dissertations. So go check it out through Amazon. Plus, you might want to pick up the new Slash record, Slash featuring Miles Kennedy and the Conspirators, World on Fire. It's their best record, the best thing Slash has done since Use Your Illusion, in my opinion. But hey, you can buy whatever you want. Buy a computer, go buy some books, go buy some clothes. Amazon has everything. You got to do some Christmas shopping, so this is the way to do it. And listen, the truth about my Amazon links, you want to know the truth? You can buy whatever you want, and it won't cost you anything extra. No hidden fees or extra charges. So if you happen to be doing some Amazon shopping, you can help out this show in the process, okay? You help out me in the process. You scratch my back, I scratch yours. Good, good, good. Go to podcastone.com. Click on the Keep Our Podcast Free banner at the top of the page. Then hit the Talk is Jericho button. Bookmark it as well so you can get those links in one easy click. Okay, the Cinderblock Party with Texas Hippie Coalition and Shamus Harvest is underway right now. We played our first show last night at the Machine Shop in Flint, Michigan. A sold-out, awesome crowd. The place was jam-packed. This tour is kicking off with a huge, huge start. Tonight we'll be rocking Steger, Illinois at Another Hole in the Wall. Then Saturday at Mill City Nights in Minneapolis, it's going to be another great show. Sunday in Des Moines, Iowa, at Woolies, home of Corey Taylor, Talk is Jericho alumni. Monday, we're rolling through Pops in St. Louis on November 24th. Tuesday, November 25th, we're hitting Rockford, Illinois at the District. Wednesday, the 26th, in Kenosha at the Brat Shop with Jackal. That's the Turkey Beer Baster Bash for 95WIIL. Heading home for Thanksgiving, then on the 28th, the day after Thanksgiving, we'll be in Joplin, Missouri on Black Friday, except for it's Party Friday. It's Fozzy Friday. So many amazing shows coming up with the Texas Hippie Coalition and Shaman's Harvest. All the dates, all VIP information, all ticket information at FozzyRock.com. This leg of the tour wraps up December 12th in Tampa, Florida. And then in March, we're going overseas, the Cinderblock Party World Tour with supporting guests, the Dirty Youth. That starts on March 4th in Belfast, Ireland. Then we're going to Cork and Dublin, hitting the rest of the UK, Manchester, Glasgow, Scotland, London, Bristol, Brighton, Exeter, Southampton. So many great shows. Go check it out, FozzyRock.com, for all ticket information, gig information, and VIP tickets. And believe me, you're not going to want to miss the VIP Fozzy experience. We have one of the best VIP experiences that you've ever had. If you've gone, you know you're not going to be disappointed. Hit us up at Fozzy Rock. Hit us up at I Am Jericho. Hit us up at Talk Is Jericho on the Twitter if you've been a Fozzy VIP, and let us know what you think. I promise you are going to love it. This tour is going to be the best tour of the year, and you are going to have a blast. I guarantee it. Come on by and say hello, just like Slash did. Actually, I came on by his house, said hello so much. We got two parts of a great conversation. Part two is coming up very, very quickly. But first, this weekend, Survivor Series is coming up. Huge, huge, traditional Survivor Series match, Team Cena versus Team Authority, and the loser, if it's Team Cena loses, they get fired, and if Team Authority loses, they're ousted from power. I talked about that on SmackDown a few weeks ago when I made my triumphant return to the WWE, but because it's Survivor Series, you know what that means. I got to do my pay-per-view predictions, and I got my friend, actually, he's my friend now. We started out as enemies, Egypt the janitor. When I was in high school and I had my own wrestling company, Egypt came in and stopped the main event midway through. This is real, by the way. And I always had a real deep resentment for Egypt. Tracked him down, had him on the show, and now he and I have become friends. So, Egypt, it's great to have you back. What do you think about this Sunday, about Survivor Series?
Jericho, I am very excited about the Survivor Series. So many great matches on the card. So many great stipulations. So much drama. Everything is on the line at Survivor Series.
All right, well, let's go check out what's going to happen at Survivor Series. The pre-show kicks off with the return of my old rival, Fandango. Apparently, he's returning. He's learned some new dances, and he's got a new valet in Rosa Mendez. She's got some staying power. What do you think about the return of Fandango, Egypt?
I am very excited about the return of Fandango. There is not enough dancing wrestlers, especially after the firing of Brodus Clay and the breakup of the Funkadelic Twins. I love the dancing wrestler. I need to see more dancing wrestler, and I will get more dancing wrestler with Fandango.
All right, be interesting to see who he faces. A pay-per-view lineup, Divas traditional Survivor Series elimination tag match, Alicia Fox, Natalya, Naomi, and Emma versus Paige, Cameron, Summery, and Layla. Paige, one of the top guests we've ever had on Talk Is Jericho. Hugely successful. Ratings just piling up when she was on the show. I'm going to vote for her. I'm saying Paige is going to win.
Ah, Jericho, you are so biased. Why would you not vote for Natalya? She has also been on Talk Is Jericho. I am voting for Natalya to win the match and take her team to victory.
Okay, so I'm going with Paige. You're going with Natalya. Let's go with WWE Tag Team title match. Usos versus Damian Sandow and The Miz versus Los Matadores versus defending champions Stardust and Goldust. I'm going to go on a limb. I'm going to say Damian Sandow and The Miz are going to win the tag team championships. Big upset.
I've been waiting for a long time for Los Matadores to get a chance to get a victory. I love the Toritos, the little guy with the jumping and all the flying that he does. So I am going for Los Matadores to win and become the new tag world team champions.
Okay, and then a strange thing, two Divas matches on the same show, kind of weird. Title match, Nikki Bella versus AJ Lee. I'm going to say that AJ Lee retains because there's a lot of rumors that she's leaving. I bet you those are just that, rumors, and she's actually not leaving. She's staying in the WWE, and she's going to retain the title.
This one is a very tough schwaz, but I will go with Nikki Bella because she still has her sister as her valet. So Nikki Bella shall win over Ajuila.
Okay, Dean Ambrose versus Bray Wyatt. I mean, this is probably the second biggest match on the show. So I'm going to go, I think Wyatt needs a big win here. We haven't seen him in a while, and I think he should get the win and continue for a long feud against Ambrose.
I agree with you, Rare. It's rare when you and I agree, Jericho. But it's good to agree for once. I agree Bray Wyatt shall win. Follow the bazaars. Follow the bazaars. I love when he says, follow the bazaars. So I will go with the Bray Wyatt.
All right, and in the big main event, like I said, Team Cena, John Cena, Dolph Ziggler, Big Show, Eric Rowan, and Ryback. If Team Cena loses, all those guys will be fired. That's a new stipulation that's coming out on SmackDown. We've got a little spoiler alert there. Team Authority, Kane, Seth Rollins, Luke Harper, Mark Henry, and Rusev. If Team Authority loses, Stephanie and Hunter are out of power. I mean, the stipulation here, I mean, come on. If Cena, Team Cena loses, they're going to get fired. That's a typical WWE subtle hint that, hey, Team Authority is going to lose. Buy the show. Watch the show, which you can watch for free on the WWE Network. So I think it's quite obvious that Team Cena is going to win and Team Authority will lose power. I think it's going to come down to Cena and Ziggler against Rollins and Harper, and Cena will win by beating Rollins.
Oh, Jericho, that you fell into the trap of the Vince McMahon. He wants you to believe that Team Cena will win. But how shocked will you be when Team Authority wins? And suddenly, John Cena is without a job. Dolph Ziggler is without a job. Big Show is without a job. Eric Rowland is without a job. And Ryback is without a job. I think that the Team Authority will win for the big surprise. And on Monday, we will have to wait and see what will happen to Team Cena.
Well, that's an interesting theory, Egypt. I'm glad that that you were able to express your opinions. It's good to have you back, and we'll see what happens. As always, keep tabs during the show. Hit us up on the Twitter at TalkIsJericho, hashtag Jericho versus Egypt, and let us know whose predictions are better and who's overall the Nostradamus of the WWE.
Thank you, Jericho, and I will talk to you next month, and we will see who the winner is. Every month I beat you. Every day I beat you. Every minute I beat you. Every second I beat you. And I beat you now.
All right, so there you go. The big predictions for Survivor Series, like I said, which you can order on pay-per-view, or you can watch it on the network for free. What a great, great bargain. What a great deal. Check that out on Sunday. We got Slash Part 2 coming up today.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Talk is Jericho.
All right, it's time for part two of my conversation with the man in the top hat, one of the most iconic guitar players in history, my boy, my brother, my buddy, Slash. Well, you've got a really cool, like, the Slash style of riff. I mean, when you wrote a song called Slither, that hits the nail. You've got this real slithery kind of cool groove thing. Like, I'm thinking about, like, I even text you about it. We were listening to Wicked Stone from the new record in the dressing room on a couple weeks ago on tour. And that song is just so killer. So there's so many cool things going on, but it's such a real slimy, cool, groovy riff.
I like,
man.
Slimy, that's good.
Yeah, I mean, that's totally what you do best. That's your wheelhouse.
I think that's just from growing up as a kid, the things that turned me on as far as guitar stuff, like, you know, like the first opening riff of Whole Lotta Love is one of the sexiest, sleaziest sounding things.
Sleazy.
And so I think you just naturally go in the direction of what your influences are. Mm-hmm. So from, like, you know, Jimmy Page and Stones, you know, Keith and Mick Taylor, that was a big one
Mick
for me.
Mick Taylor, amazing.
And then into, like, old Aerosmith and early AC/DC, it all has that similar kind of, like,
it's dirty
alley kind of sound. And so I think I just naturally go for that, you know.
Did you see the Stones tour last year?
Yeah,
where they had Mick come out?
Yeah.
You did Midnight Rambler?
Yeah.
Oh, that was so good, man.
And Can't You Hear Me Knocking, which is probably one of the best rock guitar solos, you know.
And a song that's pretty underrated. A lot of people don't think it. You got to be a Stones fan to know that. Another one they played, too, I saw them on two separate occasions. They played Sway. as well. Mick came out one, because they switched their set lists around.
Yeah. I don't know if they played Sway when I was there or not.
Yeah, the Knockin', One Night, Sway Another, okay. And then, of course, Rambler. But I told you this story, too. It was really cool to see. They did It's Only Rock and Roll, the second song in the set. Mm. And the second time I saw them, I don't know what happened, man.
It was a train wreck, right?
Train wreck central. Keith was in Pittsburgh, and Mick was in Cleveland, and the only guy that was on was Charlie Watts. And they just kept going, and slowly watched them come back. Even Daryl Jones was confused. And then after about a minute and a half, they came back to where they had it. It was just great seeing, like, even the greatest band in rock and roll still screwing up.
I remember reading a thing that Keith said where, he was joking about how, you know, whether it was him or Charlie who on occasion would, by mistake, turn the beat around. Hmm. And it was always, you know, their thing to be like, I had it right. You're the one that fucked up. And that was their, you know, Charlie said, no, I was never wrong. You're the one that fucked up. So there's, you know, with rock and roll and that sort of feel thing, which is so essential to what rock's all about, is you have that give and take that's happening. And sometimes you can turn around. Mm-hmm. And then once you've turned around, if you don't jump back, you can turn the whole thing around.
Yeah.
And someone's got to be holding it down. Otherwise, it is almost impossible to get back to
get
where,
back. Yeah. Let me ask you this. I mean, you're one of the only guys that can ask about this question. Charlie Watts was saying how when they did a lot of stadiums, I mean, they still do, but when it was 80s, 90s, stadium Stones. Mm-hmm. He said it got really hard for him to keep that feel because Mick is walking down the catwalk or mm-hmm. Mick is over here and Keith is, you know, 60 feet this way. And he said a lot of the feel is watching.
Mm-hmm.
And he said all I'm seeing is these little stick figures, you know, at the end of the rampway. It's hard to keep that together.
Yeah.
How was it playing a stadium with Guns N' Roses? Because you guys very much were in that same feel.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's that's another really great question because, like, with the Stones guys, they're essentially a garage band. Mm-hmm. I mean, a small club band on a big stage.
Yeah, where it's all this band. Room,
but they really play off of each other. Mm-hmm. And so basically you're seeing this massive production and there's just, you know, basically five guys that are playing very sort of off of, you know, playing the song, but it's very raw kind of form. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like there's not a lot of bells and whistles going on. It's 1, 2, 3, 4.
That's right.
And they're playing four or five chords. And, you know. So I totally get that because with Guns N' Roses, you know, we had these ego ramps that went off, you know, on either side of the house and so on and so forth. And there becomes delay issues and all this stuff.
Right.
So all of a sudden you have to really start thinking as you're doing. It's like, you know, patting your head and rubbing your tummy at the same time. You're running out there and the energy's carried you out there. It's not something you really thought about. And then all of a sudden you're listening for the downbeat to make sure, or you're listening for the snare, listening for one, just to make sure that you don't get away from that.
Right.
And then you try and spend as little time for any length of time out there and get back so you can all sort of lock in and make sure you didn't get, you know.
Yeah, that you're too far out in space or you got lost in the black hole. And this is pre-inner ears too.
Oh, yeah.
Would you have monitors at the end of the ego ramps?
I think what we had was, sunken monitors on either side,
Okay.
Because otherwise, because when you're going down, if you're trying to listen to the house, what ends up happening is just delay city. You know, it's really hard to sort of discern what is actually coming out in real time.
Right. Yeah. It might be easier nowadays if you actually had the in-ears. You never do, right?
No, I can't stand them. It's something I think there's a few guitar players. I know Joe is one of them. That sort of
Joe Perry?
Yeah. There's an ambience that comes out of the amp that mixes with the room, you know, whatever size venue you're playing, that you can't get with in-ears. It just sounds very small and boxed in. And it's hard to play with the kind of energy
and hit the
guitar the way that you want it to because it just doesn't sound like that.
Yeah, so I can imagine it'd be hard to you know, lock in with that much space.
Yeah.
And it's so spacious. I was going to ask you another question too. Hanging out with Duff over in Australia last year, obviously super cool guy, great. What are you talking about? It was just his hands. Hey, he was telling me all the stories about, you know, how he's so clean now, obviously sober as you are. How was your playing when you got sober in comparison to when you were drinking? Did you notice a difference?
Well, let's see. You know, there's a thing about playing under the influence that it's like being a chemist. Mm-hmm. You have to sort of make sure, you know, that you can't go too far over. You can't mix too much of this and that, you know, or you're going to screw up
right.
your balance, right? So, you know, it was always, for the most part, at least for me, it was always under the influence of alcohol. Mm-hmm. When I was on stage, I never carried my other bad habits on the road with me because I never wanted to deal with that day running out and getting sick on the road.
Or traveling overseas or something.
Yeah, any of that. So it was all about sort of keeping on an even keel. So there was a looseness to playing drunk, you know, mm-hmm. or you know, with a few cocktails.
Buzzed, and,
That was, you know, sort of like a cool thing, you know, mm-hmm. I'll give it that. But then at the same time, you know, you never knew what mood, you know, exactly what your day was like. And sometimes, you know, you could be a little bit burned out for the show because how, you know, maybe, especially waiting around 3 hours before shows. That was
question,
always really hard.
You know, when you know, okay, we're on at 9. So
then you can plan it out. It's all good. But when you're not really sure when
10,
you're going to go on, and then you just sort of keep drinking. And you
know. That's what Duff was saying. That's why he drank so much vodka, because by the time you went on at 11 or 12, he was planning for 9 and then had to keep drinking. And then by the time you hit midnight, it's like...
Yeah, it's a crapshoot.
Done, yeah.
But, you know, I remember the first shows that I did. You know, I've had some real disaster gigs going out and starting a song and not remembering how it goes and the band just waiting around. I've had... mishaps with the intro to any number of songs, Sweet Child included, where I was like, oh, you know,
how does this go again?
But anyway, so with Velvet Revolver, I went through sort of a dark period from 2005 into or mostly 2006, where I just went way back down to sort of like my ultimate bottom. And that was when I really realized that it's just not really fun anymore. So when I got sober, I was in rehab, and Scott decided, oh, I want to do some shows. Mm-hmm. So I left rehab to go do the first sober shows I'd ever done. And that was like basically...
How was that?
It was interesting because I'm not a very outspoken person. Like when I get on stage, I really sort of become insular. Like, that's why the hat really works for me, and I put my hair in my face, and I get behind the guitar. Yeah. I even with glasses on, I have a hard time making eye contact with the audience. It really freaks
okay.
me out. So suddenly going out, and a drink always took the edge off.
Right.
So walking out there and playing in front of, we were playing these sheds without a cocktail, I was very shaky and very... nervous.
Unsure of yourself?
Not necessarily unsure. Well, that's the thing with me is like going on stage for me is always very nerve-wracking. Like I'm very anxious to get up there, but I'm really nervous and very high-strung. I'm very like pensive at the same time. And then you work that out in the first few bars or in the first song. So with playing sober for the first time, it was like, oh my God, this is raw nerves and just like
exposed.
But then, you know, once you get over that initial shock, it actually, you know, it's fine. And then you start to realize as a player, being sober has allowed me to grow as a player, where drinking sort of kept you within a certain comfort zone and it was hard to really expand on that. So being sober has made it so I actually really get into every note that I'm playing, and I know what I'm doing, and I'm very much more into it, you know, than where I was just sort of off the cuff doing it, which has got a cool thing to it,
but it
doesn't necessarily always work.
It's cool when you're in your 20s and maybe your 30s as you get older. I think Van Halen was the same. He's like, he said that he was drunk for every gig up until in like 1995 or something. Like every gig? How many gigs did you play? You know, and it just seems like it's more
when you're an alcoholic, it's every day.
Well, that's right. Especially when you're on the road. Like, I mean, even like I'm not an alcoholic, but dude, I drink a lot when I'm on the road because you're just bored.
Yeah.
You know, you go do one of those festival tours like Uproar or something. We're on at 5, done at 5:45, and then you sit there till a bus call at 3 in the morning.
Well,
what are you going to do?
That's the biggest, I mean, the biggest thing for me to sort of have to learn, and it took the longest, was, you know, there from as a kid, you know, 19, 20, all the way to, you know, up to a certain point, it was just partying. It was all fun, and it was a way to kill time. And
finish the gig and start the party.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, we did it more hardcore than most people because we were more hardcore than most people. Yeah. But it was all in good fun. And then somewhere there's this invisible transition where it turned into like the major crutch. Mm-hmm. You know, and especially in the 90s when we were doing the big stadium gun stuff, and you find that you become very much physically and as well as mentally dependent on all this stuff, and you realize that you use it to fill all the gaps in mm-hmm. everything that goes on when you're not playing on stage.
Right.
And you get off the road, right, after touring at that pace. For you know, we would go out for more than 2 years, you know, pretty much straight, and you come home and everything just stops and you don't know what to do with yourself. Yeah. So you become really sort of subconsciously self-destructive. You start doing that, you know, it's just to,
it's a lot of boredom,
kill
right?
more time. Yeah,
there's a great picture we've talked about it before of the Stones and Guns N' Roses.
I'm not in it.
You're not in it, and Ron Wood isn't in it. I was like, where were you guys? You're like, oh, we were out in the limo. Where were you?
Well,
do you
I know where I was. That was because it was in Los Angeles, and we were off the road, and I had gone into a very serious smack haze. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, we had these gigs. And I'll tell you the whole story. I went... We got the offer to do the Stones gigs.
Open for the Stones. Gosh.
And we weren't doing anything, and the band was completely splintered. Mm-hmm. You know, I was in my place, not even coming out except for to go to the store. That was it.
Yeah. Hiding.
Steven was in his place. Duff was in his place. I don't know where Axel was, and Izzy was in his place. And we weren't communicating. We weren't trying to really jam. We weren't doing anything band-like. And we needed to get back up and running. So this offer for the Stones came, and my manager, who knew, was very aware of the condition that I was in, said, you know what, you guys, that would be the straw that broke the camel's back. You can't handle going out and opening for the Stones. And I said, let's go check them out. They're setting up for their first show, and I think it was Pittsburgh or something. Mm-hmm. So he and I flew out there, and on the way we stopped for a Great White, like something having to do with Great White. So we flew to another state.
The band Great White?
Yeah.
Okay, did you see them?
No. So I stayed in the hotel room. I was traveling.
Oh,
with,
okay.
And I stayed at the hotel, and I needed, I don't want to say it.
Yeah, you needed apparatuses.
Yeah. So I concocted this whole thing with the front desk to the point where they managed to get stuff from the doctor for me.
Wow.
And then I tore my entire room, the mattress, everything into smithereens. So... my manager comes back and he sees the state that I'm in and the room's in, and he's just like, oh God. Right. So then off we go to Pittsburgh, and they're all set up in this stadium, and went down to soundcheck, saw Charlie Watts's 40-year-old drumhead. Yeah. And then went back to the room to wait for the gig. And then I passed out. Mm-hmm. And so, the next day they pick us up to go to the airport, and Alan's like, so you didn't see the gig at all last night? No, I fell asleep. Anyway, so we go back to LA, and he goes, you guys are in no condition to do these shows. I said, we have to do it. We need it. It's for the band. You know, we got to go. We got to do these gigs. And so we book them, and we went up there, and I had a really serious habit going on at the time. And we did a warm-up show at the Cat House, which was total Guns N' Roses mayhem, but it was at the Cat House. It was our gig. It was okay.
So it's okay, right.
But
and when you say that, you mean kind of sloppy or just
sloppy,
raw.
Chaos, yeah. Stage diving. You
right,
know,
nuts, yeah.
And it was a good set, all mm-hmm. things considered. Mm-hmm. And also because we haven't played in a long time, so there was that fierce, like, wanting to get out and jam, you know. Anyway, so we get up with the Stones, and then right the night – let's see, we did the – what was the deal? We did the first – gig, and it was a disaster. And this isn't at LA Coliseum, big, right?
Yeah, and plus you're playing with the Stones. And, they ain't no joke either.
Well, no, of course. Right. But then I don't even think that I was aware of how big we were. So, like, there was a lot of eyes on us. We had become something bigger than what we'd left.
You didn't realize how big
band.
The band had grown.
I had no idea how big we were becoming.
Because this was just after Appetite, between Appetite and Illusion.
Yeah. I think Lies had already come out at that point.
Okay.
But we were selling a lot of records. But I was secluded in my house playing with my snakes. I didn't know.
You had no idea.
And so we go out there and we do this, and the band literally falls apart on stage.
Wow, like a train wreck.
Yeah, and I spent most of the set standing in front of my amp with it back to the audience, and I think it, at some point Axl had fallen off the stage, and it was just like, but to the public, apparently, it was very entertaining. Right? But Axl was pretty pissed off about the whole thing, and he was definitely discouraged by the fact that I was carrying like a 75-pound monkey on my back, mm-hmm. kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So he said he wasn't going to play the next show. So this was like 4 o'clock in the morning after the first show.
Wow.
I get this phone call. And so basically what it came down to was he wanted me, if we're going to do the show, he wanted me to go up and apologize.
On stage.
In front of all
90,000 people.
And I was like, I just got to get the gig. The show's got to go on, blah, blah, blah. And so I went up there, but I talked about heroin, and I sort of twisted the words around into something that he thought was an apology, but it definitely wasn't. And we ripped into Mr. Brownstone, and we started to come back together at that point. And then we did the third show, and the band played its awesome gig. But those Stones, so every night after the show, I would run off the stage, get in my car, and fix in the car.
Wow, that quick, yeah.
So that's why I wasn't in the Stones photo, yeah.
How rock and roll is Slash that you were so rock and roll you didn't show up for the picture with the Stones.
With the Stones. No, it's not how rock and roll is helped out.
Yeah, how crazy, yeah. Right? Yeah. And that's the thing. I mean, you mentioned being in this haze and not realizing how big Guns N' Roses was. Did you realize it? You know, in the early 90s with Huge Illusion, like, well, you guys were the biggest band in the world. I mean, how is that for you?
I think the key thing was we did some South American shows while we were doing User Illusions.
Mm-hmm.
I think Rio and Argentina. I'm not sure which countries they were, but and in a stadium. Headlining, you know, and that was really a big sort of eye opener. And then we went straight from there to designing a headlining set to go out and start this headlining tour, which started in Chicago, I remember.
Which was also stadium, right?
Yeah, it was, I don't know if it was a stadium. It was a big outdoor venue.
It was leading to the stadium.
Whatever it was, right. Yeah. And all of a sudden everything just went into really high gear, you know, like the kind of high gear that you sort of marveled at when you were a kid reading rock magazines and looking at guys like the Stones and Aerosmith and that whole thing. For me, it was always about just, I loved when we were playing theaters and we were headlining and we were just this raunchy, band like that.
Live at the Ritz.
That was the level that I was really comfortable of. I didn't have any ambitions to be really massive, you know, like U2 big or anything like that.
Or Stones big.
And so all of a sudden we just arrived at that point, and it was all moving so quickly that it was almost, my head was spinning, you know. But it was fun. I mean, we go out and play in front of these huge audiences, and again, we were just talking about a garage band with a couple amps and going out there and like this sea of people reacting to any one of our songs. So it was really cool. But I think a lot of the band itself as a whole was a mess. You know, it was a pretty crazy. It was very rock and roll looking back on it, but at the time living it, it was total mayhem.
Do you look back at those times and like because that's a pretty amazing thing. I mean, it became the biggest band in the planet. How many bands can you say that? 10, 20, you know? I mean, that's a pretty amazing thing that you guys accomplished. You look back and go, like, that was pretty pretty good time.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I think more than anything, I was just proud of, Guns N' Roses was not designed or tailor-made for superstardom, you know? Very, very volatile, very sort of street savvy, but not really a little rough around the edges kind of a sort of band. And then, you know, succeeding on our own merit without ever conforming to what everybody else did to try and become,
big,
popular.
Right.
And so we sort of did it, our own rules, we forced it through and we actually succeeded at it. So I was always very proud of that. But, and then all of a sudden to be playing stadiums, the thing that was always weird for me, it was great to have achieved that, but it was a bittersweet kind of a thing as well, because the band had crossed over to the point where, you know, a lot of what I thought was really cool about the band, where it had its core audience, which was very hardcore, And it just had this really sort of cool thing, sort of like what I would think about Motorhead, you know, where it's just, it's got its audience and it does its thing.
Oh, yeah.
And all of a sudden being so acceptable, you know, on so many levels and, you know, reaching this very broad audience. And even to this day, you know, seeing people walking around with Guns N' Roses shirts that don't know what Guns N' Roses is.
It's just because it's cool, like Motorhead or Ramones.
Yeah, yeah. So right? I'm not, you know, like knocking it, but at the same time, it was a really weird thing for me to sort of like try and comprehend exactly what that was all about.
It becomes big business and a corporation, not just the rock and roll band anymore. Yeah. Do you ever think, like, and not even about a reunion or anything, but just the fact that if you guys did a show, just one show, and you could play a stadium. Mm-hmm. And the fact that, how many rock bands play stadiums now? U2?
AC/DC.
Maybe Springsteen, AC/DC, you know, Metallica or Maiden if they're in Finland.
Mm. Metallica's
Metallica could do, you know, the big four, they did stadiums. Yeah. You know, they could do it with the right thing, or even if it's just Metallica live, whatever. But then it's, you know, Taylor Swift, and it's One Direction, and it's, you know, Luke Bryan, and it's all that sort of thing. Do you ever think, like, do you ever miss playing a stadium and go, man, like, just being a musician and being you, you're a lot like me. Like you said, I want to be the best horror movie producer. I want to be the best guitar player. Do you ever think, like, I want to do it just one more time because we can. We can play a stadium and not hardly anybody can.
I'm too stubborn.
Yeah.
I mean, I go out and we do festivals and stuff like that, and those are big festivals.
Huge.
I love doing them, but I only like to do them, you know, they're in the summertime in Europe and on occasion in a couple other different places. But I love playing in the, we're going to be playing arenas.
I know, right? I was going to bring
I'm sort
that
of
up
like,
next,
okay,
yeah.
Well, let's slow down, you know. I mean, I appreciate the fact that we can fill, you know, hopefully fill an arena. But at the same time, I love that sort of intimacy of playing in front of an audience that I can see. And even though I don't look, I can feel them.
you can hear them.
That automatic millisecond between hitting a note and then, you know, that
the reaction.
That,
yeah.
It's something about stadiums. Even if the whole place loves the song, there's a disconnect that happens. And so it's great to be able to do it, but to do it every single day and that's all you ever do, it's sort of like living in a weird sort of a surrealistic bubble, you know?
Yeah. So, even too, like if someone said, if you could do one show, but even that's a whole can of worms because just to get together for one show, how much?
Oh, it's a whole production. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
right?
It's expensive.
Negotiation.
Yeah.
But even just getting there.
Oh, you're talking about, like, well,
I'm just
know.
Saying, you know, like, let's say they said Slash, Guns N' Roses, one last show in LA
that's
Stadium.
That's a bigger thing because it's really up to five guys to really sort of be on the same page and want to do that. And that's just something that hasn't really been discussed because nobody's really into doing it. Because
that's even the thing.
Yeah, so
we would have to have the original five.
And it has to be a band decision, more or less. So, you know, there's all this talk and reunion and this and that and the other, and that's everybody else in the world trying to figure out what our future is going to be. You know, usually, I mean, all things considered, it's a lot of people with a lot of money making all the offers. But the most key thing about any of that, before any of that stuff is even discussed, is where the band really gets together and goes, hey, you know, between us, we'd really like to get together
Can
and play. And we haven't even been in the same room. I haven't talked to Axl since 1996.
Mm-hmm.
So let's stop jumping to conclusions.
Right. Yeah. And that's why I wasn't asking the cliche question. I was just wondering,
just saying,
knowing,
the,
oh, sure, of course, but just knowing that you could and knowing how rock and roll is now with the stadium available, you know.
Yeah.
But
you can't deny feeling good about having
that we could do
and do that. You know?
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to keepitfunohio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
You're listening to Talk is Jericho.
I'm here talking to Slash in his very own house. Now, you and Miles Kennedy and the Conspirators are doing an arena tour of Europe. You guys are playing Wembley in London on December 2nd. It's Wembley Arena. that's the sign that you've made it in the UK.
All things considered, I remember Guns playing the first Wembley game.
Wow, yeah. And so, it's, you know, we've wrestled there before, and it's just an arena. It's cool, but it's Wembley. Yeah. It says Wembley.
Well, there is that sort of like in a name. Mm-hmm. You know, there's those venues. For me, it's the Forum in LA. Wembley is one of them. I mean, Download has always been.
That's a great one.
I played Download in, I think, four times in four separate bands. I don't know if anybody else can say that.
Yeah. So it was Guns N' Roses, I know, is 88.
Guns N' Roses, Snake Pit, Velvet Revolver, and
So you did Snake Pit too. Yeah. There you go.
But yeah, so there's particular venues all over the world where there's a certain...
The Garden.
Yeah, the Garden.
Reputation, yeah, and the vibe. History.
I feel bad not mentioning the name of every single one of them, but all around the planet, you know, in Argentina, it's River Plate, you know, there's all these, and they have this prestige, you know? So yeah, there's definitely that kind of...
So are you excited? I mean, this is the biggest gigs that you've played as Slash and the Conspirators.
I'm excited. I haven't even really thought about that aspect of it. I'm more right now, we start rehearsing tomorrow. I don't know when this is going to air, but we start rehearsing tomorrow. And then, and so I'm like going, trying to figure out for the first set that we're going to do in Ireland, what the set's going to be. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm going to sit down and focus on it, because now there's all this new material, which I'm excited about doing.
How do you choose a set now?
Well, you have a couple standards. You know, I'm going to, I don't plan on taking Night Train out, you know. Mm-hmm. Sweet Child of Mine is one of those that you can take out depending on a venue. Like,
really?
If you're playing like a full on fast paced heavy metal thing, you can take it out and people don't miss it. I've done that before, where, you know, and
if it's like a festival or something, where you got 45 minutes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We're playing in between Slayer and,
which happens sometimes. You get Slayer.
Oh no, we did. Yeah,
Slayer and Mastodon and Slash in the middle or something. Yeah.
It's hard to play Sweet Child of Mine in the midst of that. But there's some standards in Set Paradise City, and there's Anastasia. You're a Lie, you know, there's songs that we'll always play. And so we interchange everything else. And so I just sit down with I get one set list together for the first show. And then the next day, take that same set list and cross out songs and put other songs in there. And it just turns into a thing you do every day.
Are all your songs in the same tuning?
No. Well, they used to be, we used to be in standard and E flat. Mm-hmm. Which is a real pain in the ass. So now we've managed to keep everything at E flat. And the only thing I have to worry about tuning wise is like if there's open tuning or something like that. But at least I'm not like switching guitar. Because your ear, the transition from E to E flat, from song, like from one song to the next, all of a sudden everything sounds really weird.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. One thing with Fozzy is that Rich Ward, our guitar player, he writes the songs always in different tunings. So when I put together the set, I got asked, what tunings are these songs? What tunings? So try and group them together so it's not change guitar. Because you want to keep the flow too. As the front man, I don't want to have to wait, you know, 2 minutes while they're tuning and stuff. So that's something that drives me crazy.
That's another, you're spot on. Maybe it's just doing an interview with somebody else who plays. Yeah. Because that's a big one. It's like, okay, the first four songs are one guitar. And then if there's going to be a switch, it has to be after that many. At least three songs, just to keep the whole momentum.
Keep the flow.
And we know how to switch guitars really fast. And my guitar tech, it's got the worst job in the world because I'm on him like crazy. You know? and it's got to be in tune too. Don't give me an out of tune guitar. I'll go.
That's right. Nothing worse.
So Ace has got a very tough job. So I do like three or four songs, and then switch, and then at least two or three before the next switch. So the songs have to work out in the same tuning to be looped
together.
And sometimes I switch guitars just sound-wise, you know.
Right.
So we write on the set list all the changes and what guitars are changing to and all that.
How many GNR songs do you include in your headline set? Do you say, like, I'll do four tonight, or do you just go with the flow, or do you have to put a certain amount in there?
Well, it's actually gotten less and less, depending, like, from when we first started to at this point. I think we do, like, let's see, Night Train. We've been playing You Could Be Mine at this point. We might do Brownstone. We might not do Brownstone. Paradise City and Sweet Child of Mine. Those are the main four songs.
Those are the
songs,
ones,
And then, you know, like... Todd sings You're Crazy or Out to Get Me. And so to give Miles a break, Todd will go up and sing one of those two songs and the Lemmy song.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, so There's a lot of Guns material in there. I didn't play any of it for years, and so when we started doing this, like, let's do the whole catalog thing, it was a real shot in the arm for me to go back and play some songs that I hadn't played in a really long time.
Do you have to go and kind of relearn them?
I try not to do that, but I'll go into rehearsal, and if I make everybody sit around for too long where I'm just staring at my guitar, then I'll go and listen to it.
You know, my favorite GNR song that probably will never get played, I don't know if you ever played, did you ever do Locomotive?
We did do Locomotive.
With GNR? Or
with GNR, not in our band.
Once again, that's a slimy riff.
Yeah, it's a very cool riff. Slimy. It's a cool great song, groove, but it's there's a lot of words per minute, and I think it was just too hard to basically sing and breathe at the same time. Yeah.
There's certain songs you can do in the studio,
that
you can't ever bust out live.
Yeah, it's too taxing. So we played it a few times, but it just didn't really manage to stay in the set.
Yeah. Well, before we wrap up, I want to talk to you. It'd be remiss without talking about our other favorite subject, which is dinosaurs. I know, dinosaurs. Finally, you've been waiting for that. Sorry. What is your fascination with dinosaurs? Same as horror movies?
That came early on. Like, when I was in England, I'm not sure the first thing I saw that was dinosaur related, but we used to take the train from Stoke into London and we'd go to the Natural History Museum in London, which is one of the great European natural history museums. And I just was in love with dinosaurs, and I learned all their, you know, like most kids learned all their names. But there was a cool place in London called Crystal Palace, which is where, which one is it, Marsh or the guys who first really discovered dinosaurs. So what they did was they found their first real dinosaur skeletons. So they had Megalodon, there was Iguanodon, there was a sort of Ichthyosaurus, and this and that and the other. And so their first attempts at reconstructing these skeletons were all anatomically incorrect. So what they did is they built life-size statues in their natural habitat of these animals with trees and coming out of the water and this and that and the other, and they had a big banquet inside their depiction, their interpretation, I guess, of an iguanodon as a four-legged with a horn on his nose.
You're right, they messed it up.
And inside the body they'd carved out, and they all sat inside there, right, and had this banquet, and it was over the discoveries and this and that. Well, Crystal Palace is this park. It's all still there. And so you can walk around. So I used to go in there and just, like, you know, trip out. You should check it out.
I've never heard of that one before.
Yeah, it's Crystal Palace. It's on the east end of London.
Okay.
Yeah.
And they still have the giant...
Oh, it's all in there, except for the banquet thing. But all the, you know, in the foliage and everything, it's all these...
What is the one that's at the New York Museum of Natural History? Sue? Now, that's Sue.
Yeah.
Now, tell us about the story of Sue. This is something that I didn't even know much about, and you kind of hit me up on it.
Well, okay, Sue was discovered, and, I don't want to say it, get the details wrong, so I'll just sort of do an overview.
For any paleontologists listening.
Yeah. But Sue was discovered, I think, and I want to say it was in Arkansas, but I could be wrong. But anyway, they found this dinosaur, and it turned out to be the biggest T-Rex ever found. They unearthed, they did all the work, got this thing pulled out. It's in pretty much complete, you know, T-Rex. And then the government said, no, it's not yours, you can't have it. And they confiscated every bone, and they took it, and then it went up for auction.
But why? Because it's part of the land?
Well, yeah, the I guess because land? The government owns the land, you know. Wow. So it was a really sad story. It was on the news, and there was, especially local news. I mean, there was tons of footage on it.
Do you think the archaeologist was, or paleontologist was Sue?
So, yeah, it was, like it was a,
her
it was
name
a girl.
Was Sue.
Yeah.
And she found this entire thing, bone.
Yeah.
And they took it from her.
So a great story. And this was in the 90s, if I remember correctly. And so they confiscated it, and it was all sitting in these big, huge boxes in a warehouse for years. And then finally there was the auction in Natural History Museum, New York, American Natural History Museum bought it and mounted it, and so it's up there.
And it's huge, too.
And they have the real skeleton on display in its own, because the head is too heavy to display on the body.
Okay.
So they have it in a case, and then they have a cast of the entire dinosaur. It's really pretty cool.
So what are your favorite dinosaurs?
My favorite, one of the ones that we were talking about recently, because it's so exciting for me, they just, the Spinosaurus story. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the original bones that were found in the desert, Mongolia or something like that. I don't know. Anyway, so they this German paleontologist found these bones of this unique dinosaur, and he brought them back to the Natural History Museum in Berlin. And we had World War II, and there was a bombing raids, Allied bombing raids, and destroyed everything. And all there was his notes and his drawings. Wow. So Spinosaurus, as we knew it for years and years and years, was a
which is the toughest dinosaur, by the way. Crazier than a Tyrannosaurus Rex.
Yeah, well, you know, well, okay, I'll get into it then. So when they, the recreation of it was this, bigger than a T-Rex, and obviously with the big spine, had sort of a baryonyx-type alligator snout and so on. But they still had it standing on two big, solid hind legs because they hadn't seen any legs whatsoever. And they had the forearms and the big claws and all that kind of stuff. Well, recently, they... another paleontologist researched this and had heard about some bones that had been picked up by one of those guys that out there, and they sort of find stuff and sell it, you know.
Yeah. Scavenger.
And so tracked this guy down, and he led him to the site. And so they found a more complete version of Spinosaurus. And now it turns out that it was primarily aquatic. That the legs actually, instead of, I mean, he could walk on all fours and it could stand up, but it was really designed for being in the water. So now it's taken on a whole new look. So
yeah, it's like a whole new story behind it now.
And then Deinocharis, you know, those huge arms that we've been seeing for years with the long claws, but that's all they are. Well, they've finally found the rest of that skeleton. So that's a big one. Phil Curry and in a Tyrrell Museum in Canada, right, has now, I don't know how much of the skeleton, complete skeleton they have, but it's a big, huge plant eater, and it's really strange looking. And if you see the computer graphics, that, what do they call that, the recreation?
Yeah, right? sure.
Of it walking, it's like something out of a kid's fairy tale, like a big lumbering.
Really? And this is kind of a new species?
Yeah. Well, they just had it's got this dorky sort of turkey head, and all we had were these really long, like 6 foot long arms with these massive claws on it. And you know the Thesinosaur, right? It was sort of along those lines, where it's got these big sort of meat eater looking hands, then it's got this small sort of beaked face as a plant eater, and then it's a bit like it's a concoction made up of all these different dinosaurs.
Yeah, so it's like a platypus or something. Yeah, a Frankenstein monster. Yeah,
so favorite dinosaurs. So Spinosaurus, Deinonychus was always a favorite of mine, so I always have to give it credit. Dimetrodon.
What's the Dimetrodon?
Dimetrodon is a primitive, it's really a primitive mammal. It is from the Permian period, and it was... basically, it's got the huge sail on its back. And there was two. There was a Dilophosaurus and there was a Dimetrodon. One was a meat eater and one was a plant eater. And this was before dinosaurs even existed. And so, yeah, I'd have to show you a picture. But it's very lizard-like. It's on squat legs, but it's got a mammalian head. And it's a thecodont. So it's got, like, incisors up here and chewing teeth in the back and...
Man, you know all of your stuff, because I was always fixated on certain ones. Like, I love Allosaurus, love Stegosaurus, I love Plesiosaurus. We talk about the Loch Ness monster.
I have some more pictures of those, which
of the
Plesiosaurus and Mosasaurus.
The Mosasaurus is the one that was cool, and the Ichthyosaurus is cool too. But
whenever you see those, it means I put them up for you. I was actually going to put your name on the thing. And I thought, no, that'll be corny. I'll leave it out. He knows it's for him.
That's the secret message. Thank you. Now, did you ever, you know, the story of the coelacanth, right?
Mm-hmm.
About, I mean, that just blows my mind, too. I talk about, actually, my son is, he's 11, but he's a total fish fanatic, crazy fish expert. He was, I mean, I knew what the coelacanth when I was a kid, but he's been telling me that there was actually found like 10 or 12 of them over the years. Yeah. That blew my mind, that there was a prehistoric creature that still
imagine those
survived.
Guys on the fishing boat.
That's what I mean.
In Africa, pulling this huge, gruesome fish up and going,
what is this? Right, and people going, this is a prehistoric animal.
There's one on display, preserved at the Natural History Museum here in Los Angeles.
Oh, really?
Have you been to the museum here?
No, I haven't.
It used to be one of the worst natural history museums in the country. And then they just renovated it and did this whole addition thing to it. Now it's like this amazing dinosaur location.
Okay.
So you should check it out.
I was looking up a couple just to see. Have you ever heard of the Majungasaurus?
I have heard of the Majungasaurus. I'm trying to remember. It is a sauropod.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. It's massive, and it's from China.
It's kind of a cannibal. Yeah. It eats other dinosaurs, is what it was saying.
Oh, no.
Yeah,
I didn't
that was
know
the
that.
One. But the other thing, too, is this was a good one. Did you ever hear about the Troodon?
Yeah, with the big brain.
Let me go through. Do you know what Excalibursaurus is?
No.
That's a swordfish. Oh. A prehistoric swordfish.
Is it really called
Excalibur? It's called the Excalibursaurus. Yeah.
Okay.
What about the Kronosaurus?
I do know what that is.
It's crazy.
I'm trying to think of what it looks like. I know the name.
It's a water beast.
Yeah.
And then have you ever heard the Sarcosuchus?
Let me see. Let me see it on.
It's like a giant crocodile.
Yeah. That's all the Sucuses are crocodilians.
Okay.
Yeah. Like Photosuchus, Phytosuchus, they're sort of, they're like primitive crocodiles, but they're still look like big lizards. And so all those, they all have crocodilian ancestors.
Okay. See, I'd never heard of that before, the Sarcosuchus. Like I said, to me, I always like the Plesiosaur, the Allosaurus. I love the Triceratops because it just looks so weird with the big, you know,
all
spinal
the Ceratopsians
thing.
Are awesome.
Yeah, they all look very strange.
There's a Ceratopsian skull. You know, in all these museums, they've got warehouses full of bones that they haven't really put together yet or matched with other things. And so sometimes you can come up with a new discovery, and it's just some bones that have been laying around for like 40 years that they put together. And went, oh my God, right? And then all of a sudden, there's a ceratopsian, you know, I can't remember what it's called, and it hasn't been shown yet, but it's at the I don't know if I should supposed to say it, but it's at the museum over there, and I saw it, and it's just in the warehouse, and they haven't announced it.
Okay. Do you go to these places when you're on the road if you have a day off and try and find a museum?
Yeah, it's the one, because I don't do much when I'm on the road. It's like we have very little time off. So if you find, for me, if there's a museum within 45 hours drive and I've never been there, it's like, okay, we got to go over there, and I'll drag some of the guys with me and, you know, sort of trip them around the whole thing. And all the museums have storehouses filled with years and years of collections that don't go on display until... you know, there's some reason to display it, you know, and it has to be named and it has to be identified and all that kind of stuff. So it's
you get
a real
to see
trip.
Like the behind the scenes.
Yeah. Too. Yeah. So I'm paying the ass.
Does that freak people out when Slash is here? He says he knows about dinosaurs.
I don't know if it freaks people out. I think for a lot of them, the fact that I'm just that passionate about it, cause it's sort of a nerdy thing. You don't get a lot of people going,
oh, absolutely.
You know, little kids and older nerds. You know,
yeah.
So I'm one of them.
I remember the one text was like, what's your favorite dinosaur? And you told me, and I said, I told you mine. I was like, we're a couple of losers,
right? And we're texting about
debating like what dinosaur is better. But I've never met anybody that liked dinosaurs as much as I do until I met you, and you know way more than I do. I had to up my game to try and keep up with you.
There's so much, like one of those dinosaurs that you mentioned, there's so much new stuff I can't even keep up with it. You know, I mean, there's got to be a couple dozen flying reptiles from China that are all winged that I can't even remember the names of anymore. And they're constantly coming out. There was that new sauropod that they found, which the name is actually pretty easy, but I can't remember it now. And that's the thing. I guess after a while, your retention for dinosaur names starts to go away.
It's like a glass. So you pour it up to the top, and then you only get so much room for dinosaur names.
But, I mean, there's all these really, really cool stuff. So I try to keep up with it, but... you know, I'm aware of it, but I can't always place the name. That
you can't subscribe to like Dinosaur Monthly.
Well, I
something.
Do. I have a couple sites that I follow. I've got a friend over at Calgary University named Darla, who's a paleontologist.
Named Carla?
Darla. And she sends me stuff all the time. Oh. And she sends me like where you look at it and go, I don't know if I want to know that bad. I mean, this is like, you know, scientist names.
Well, I was going to say that because outside of Calgary, there's a town called Drumheller, which is the home of Nickelback.
Right.
But there's,
I did not know
yeah,
that.
Yeah, they're from that area. There's tons.
That's sort of a dinosaur type name. Nickelback.
Nickelback. Sure, the Nickelbackosaurus. Yeah. But there's tons of excavations
the Badlands. And that's where Tyrell Museum is,
okay.
Which is
oh, that's
is
right
that
there.
Great. Yeah, you should check that out too. It's really, really cool.
Like, I will.
It's it's only dinosaurs.
Okay.
It's a whole museum devoted, and that's where I saw that thing.
What do you think why they are extinct? Because I have a theory that might is different from normal.
Well, I mean, you know, I don't profess to know any more than anybody else, but
in your opinion,
you know, I mean, I think the asteroid, you know, had a huge impact. But I think
literally,
yeah. As I was saying it, I realized it. But you know, there was it's widely known and it's fact that dinosaurs were dying out prior to that.
Really?
Yeah. But the Cretaceous period also introduced all kinds of new plants. Mm-hmm. It also was where the continents started to separate and take different form, and you know, there was a lot of land bridges and this and that where you could have really transferred a lot of diseases and this and that and the other, and there could have been a virus that took them out along with all the other, you know, real drastic stuff that was going on, you know, as far as the asteroid was concerned and other dynamics, global changes that were happening at the time. But I think the introduction of flowering plants and stuff like that might have killed off the herbivores, which in turn killed off the carnivores.
Yeah. Have you ever heard of the theory of the Nigerosaurus? This is a fairly new one I just discovered, I guess about a year or 2 years ago. You should Google it. Niger, like Nigeria.
Yeah, and that's a new discovery, a dinosaur that's recent.
Fairly
yeah.
new. And what yeah. they're saying is that these guys were like, they were smaller, and they were like, they would suck up plant life. They were like lawnmowers.
Oh, is that the one with the big wide scoop?
Yes, that would just scoop, like, it wouldn't even chew. It would just suck up all the plants and grass. And they were saying that could have contributed too, because all the food was gone for the herbivores, which when they died killed the carnivores, because all the food was eaten by these little vacuum cleaner guys.
It could have happened. Called the Nigerosaurus. There's so many,
you don't know for sure, right?
Yeah, and there's so many possibilities and there's so many theories. And it's funny because you listen to scientists talk, and these are really, really schooled individuals that live and breathe this stuff, and they all come up with theories that you can always you find holes in, and you know, and they go out and they make these papers and they put them out and they're scrutinized by the community, and all that kind of stuff, and it makes you really realize how far off it is to really find the answer to that.
But it was 65 to 200 million.
I love that
years
you brought
ago.
That dinosaur. See, there you go. But I've seen it's one of the handful of what they call freak dinosaurs, where it's got this jaw that is like, I don't know, what is this, 2 feet wide?
Yeah.
And it's really basically a scooping thing, like your pumpkin carver or something.
Yeah. Yeah. And not even chewing, just like, boom, boom, boom. Last question. You've done so many guest appearances over the years. I just wanted to ask you, who is your favorite guy that you ever played with that you did a guest appearance with? I mean, I know you did so many, but
I've been asked that. That's let me see if I mean, because they've all been uniquely different and so really cool in their own.
Is there a few that stand out?
Well, you know, obviously jamming. Like, okay, are you talking about on stage or in
either
the,
or in the studio?
In the studio, for me, it was playing with Ray Charles.
Wow,
that was when I in 2001.
That's killer.
He, I got a phone call from his engineer. I just got married. I was in Hawaii and I was supposed to be on my honeymoon. I get this phone call. Honey, we got to go. And I went back to LA and went
really,
to the
studio. Really? Had to cut your honeymoon short.
Yeah.
When Ray
don't
calls.
Don't bring it up when she's around.
I won't.
So, I went to the studio and worked on a song, on Ray's last studio record that was an original record. Mm-hmm. Or because I know he did a covers record right after that I played on as well. But then working with him and sort of hanging out with him, and he sort of took me under his wing. I have no idea why. You know, he didn't know who I was. Only his engineer did. Mm-hmm. And he was really, really cool. And that was a great experience for me. And it sort of gave me the shot in the arm that I needed to get back into it. Cause I got really sick for a period. Mm-hmm. I had alcohol poisoning and almost died. And then, so when I came out of that, I was like, I'd broken up Snake Pit and I was like, okay, now what am I going to do? And that sort of got me going. And then he passed, which was sad, but I got to work on that movie and work with his band and jam with him. Yeah. So that was cool. So that was a good one. Another one was working with Lenny Kravitz, you know,
classic.
He was just awesome. And Iggy Pop right around the same time. Those two guys were great. Jamming with Aerosmith recently, just,
that
you know,
cool.
playing
song
with them.
Did you do?
It's always Mama Kin, cause they know I know it, you know, they are like, there's so many other Aerosmith songs I could play. You know? Train kept rolling sometimes, but, playing with those guys, in Boston,
wow, hometown.
Yeah, that was a good one.
How about the Super Bowl with Michael?
Oh, well, that wasn't the Super Bowl.
No, what was it?
I did a bunch of gigs with Michael. The Super Bowl was with Black Eyed Peas,
which was cool. The studded top hat.
Well, it was a fun gig. It was an experience because there's so many moving parts going into one of those Super Bowl performances mm-hmm. and actually experiencing and watching it happen in real time and actually being part of it. It's, I mean, because you only have so many minutes in between.
And the changeover must be a nightmare because it's 5 minutes, 10 minutes.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm saying. It's like, so that was a definitely fun experience. And I love Fergie and Will.i.am and all mm-hmm. that. But working with Michael, that's another one. Michael was one of those phone calls that came literally out of the blue. And it was such a contrast because I was in a hotel room. I was at the Riot House on Sunset. I was with some girl. I had the shades drawn and we were doing our thing and the phone rings and it's my manager and he goes, Michael Jackson wants to talk to you. And it was like, huh? You know? And so I went and played on his record. He gave me free reign in the studio.
And you played
whatever.
Black or White.
I played a song called Give In To Me. That's the one I really played on. Black or White, and some fans get mad at me because the song itself, I didn't play. The intro to the song I played, which is something else entirely that they slapped
on. Like the little talking thing with
the noisy guitar stuff. But we went on from there and ended up doing a bunch of shows in Japan and Germany and Los Angeles and New York and like all. And he was just like, he just let me do my trip and then he did his trip and
so
the rest
of
everything.
So did he just invite you, say, hey, I got a show in, you know, New York, come play with me?
Yeah, I'm playing in this crazy little town in Italy. Come on out, fly you out and go up and jam, you know. And I play the Beat It, and I'd play Give In To Me, and I'd play Black or White.
Black
so
or
I
White,
ended
yeah.
up live playing it with him all the time. But
because he always liked having a hot guitar player, whether you looked at, you know, like you said, Beat It or Dirty Diana, or you know, he always liked having that rock element there.
Well, you know, I think there's something like when he did the Beat It thing, that was a Quincy Jones call, right? Mm. But then I think everybody picked up on that, and so he got Steve Stevens to do Dirty.
Right.
When he called me up, I think he was just toying with the idea of doing it again, doing that kind of thing on this next record. But when we played live, I think his big thing is he just thought I was such a whack-looking character to have up there, you know? Because he really, I remember one time he's like, I showed up and he said, where's the top hat? And I said, I didn't bring it. He goes, oh, you need the top hat, you know?
It's part of your gimmick, man.
Yeah, but he was very, very cool and an interesting guy to hang out with because he was really just a really sweet, very talented guy in the midst of this. I mean, he loved his very much a perfectionist as mm-hmm. far as the production and the entertainment like aspect of what he was doing, like what people were seeing. He was very keen on every detail of what the show was and all that. But he was such an institution and had so many people working around him. And he was a really, like, at that time, Guns was pretty much as big as it was getting. It was, you know, it had gotten as big as it was going to get. And it wasn't a quarter of the sort you know,
that's a different level.
And it was scary and in some ways sort of sad to watch him sort of, it was very much alone and 45 people around him at any given time and not one person that he could honestly trust.
Right.
Know?
That one, a bunch of yes men surround him. Did you ever like hang out with him at all? Or
we used to hang out all the time. That was cool. Because that's why I got to really sort of know him and then see the contrast between his personality and the massive circus that was going on around him. Mm. You know? And the only thing he seemed really dialed into was himself and the dancers.
The choreography.
Gotcha. Thank you. Yeah. And just the production of what people were seeing, you know, like, you know, like what the beats were and where the flash pot was going to go.
Yeah.
And
kind
of experience. And the rest of it was just like, do your job, but I don't know what you're doing because there's 80 of you. And
right. Last question. Where'd you get the name Slash?
From, Seymour, do you know who Seymour Cassell is? He's
no.
an actor.
Okay.
You know who John Cassavetes is, right? Well, there was John Cassavetes was sort of like this
big time director.
Yeah, he was a director, but he's also an actor.
Yeah.
And there was a whole crew. It was Seymour Cassell, Ben Gazzara, John Cassavetes, and a couple other people that were sort of they were sort of against the grain in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. They were all tough guys and, you know, sort of rough around the edges and drinkers and, you know. And so Seymour's kid was my best friend when we were in high school. And so we used to ditch school and hang out at Seymour's house. And as long as we pruned all the pot plants and did some chores, we could hang out there and smoke pot all day. And, you know, I'd play my guitar there all day and we'd party and this and that. And, you know, I had a band going at the time, and so I was always scheming on the next thing I was going to do, and I was always in a hurry, and I could never, like, stop and talk. I would always be on the go, you know? It's like I was always talking to my back, so he used to just call me Slash.
You know? He's like a slashing guy.
Yeah, and it just became a nickname that stuck through high school. And
became your name.
Yeah, so.
When I pulled up at the gate, I was like, they're like asking me who you're here to see, and I was like, do I even say his real name? Yeah. I'm here to see Slash. All right. Dude, thank you so much, man. Thanks for having me over.
It's great. You came down
great
here.
Great conversation, man. Yeah, absolutely. So much fun.
I've been looking forward to this. So I was, you know, because we text so much. So
I know.
It's like to actually see you for a change. Would be
I nice. Know. It's actually cool to know that we're actually people.
In this
day and age, it's all about the texting, but actually having a conversation, nothing beats it. So thanks, man.
All right. Thank you.
All right, I want to thank Slash, my boy Slashy, for being here. Great conversation. Once again, Slash said it was one of the favorite interviews he's ever done in his entire career, which is a huge feather, pat in the back for me. Feather in the cap, feather in the back, pat on the ass. So many great things, so many cliches. Hey, listen, if you want to see Slash featuring Miles Kennedy and the Conspirators on the road, you need to go check them out live. One of the best live bands I've seen. Super tight, and of course Slash is such an amazing guitar player. They're in Munich, Germany on Saturday, Cologne on Sunday, Amsterdam on Monday, November 24th, Brussels on the 26th, Manchester, England on the 28th, Leeds on the 29th, Birmingham December 1st, and playing the famous Wembley Arena in London on December 2nd, Glasgow on the 4th, and they wrap up their European tour on December 6th in Reykjavik, Iceland. These are all arena shows. That's how big Slash featuring Miles Kennedy and the Conspirators have gotten. Congratulations. Couldn't happen to a better group of guys. And if you haven't already checked out Slash's new record, World on Fire, with Miles Kennedy and the Conspirators, you need to. It's a great record. I think it's the best thing Slash has done since Guns N' Roses, and I have all of his records. And you know where the best place is to get it, right? Huh? Amazon. Using the Talk is Jericho links, and I know you know how to find them. Go to podcast1.com, click on the Keep Our Podcast free banner at the top of the page, then click on Talk is Jericho. You see all three of my Amazon links in the UK, the USA, and Canada. Every time you do that, Amazon kicks back a little cash to the show so we can keep doing this for you for free for twice a week. No extra fees or hidden challenges. You're just getting your shopping done. You're helping me on the process. Christmas is coming, man. You need a place to go to buy all your presents. Amazon is the way to do it, and do it through our Keep Our Podcast free banner at the top of the page, the Chris Jericho Talk is Jericho banner. Help us all out. Get your presents. Make us happy. Everybody wins. Speaking of winning, although we're finished, Slash show is done. We're finished for this week. But in the meantime, in between time, it's another great edition of Talk is Jericho's finished. I want you to stay hard, stay hungry, peace, love, and hugs. And next Wednesday, I got the hottest heel in the business today on the show. Yeah, that's right. Seth Rollins is going to be here. Who's bringing you the best guests, huh? I mean, come on. Who's bringing you the best guests right here? Who's the best podcast in the world right here? Talk is Jericho. Seth Rollins next week. We'll see you there. Yeah, boy.
You can download new episodes of Talk is Jericho every Wednesday and Friday at podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com.